Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and as promised to listeners, a lot of requests last week, really engaged conversations around Ukraine, and we said we would be covering the topic in more detail. And I am delighted to say that we've managed to get a really excellent guest, in my opinion. We are speaking to Ukrainian MP. She's a member of the People's Serving Party, and she's also head of the permanent delegation of the PACE. PACE, if you're not familiar with it, folks, the Parliamentary Assembly Council of Europe. We're joined by Maria Mezentseva. Maria, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I know you're on the road. You're a busy lady, so thanks for fitting us in.
Thank you very much for this great opportunity to address your radio listeners.
No, I am, and we really appreciate it. Look, we'll jump straight in, and I will ask you just from your point of view, the origins of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Before we came on air, we were speaking for a few seconds, and you mentioned that you want to point to, you know, the key point as you see it. Do you want to just give me your how you would frame it and how you think listeners should understand that this didn't just happen in the last few months? This has been a continuation of events since, as you put it, 2014.
Yes, sure. Well, I am speaking not as just a politician, but also a war volunteer of a war, which is a very modern one, and the one happening in front of our eyes for the last 8 years, touching upon not only Ukrainian land, but also the whole subcontinent of Europe, and from the very recent time becoming a center of geopolitics. I would say that back in 2014, we had no understanding that the revolution of dignity, and this was the second revolution already happening after the Orange one, would lead to something like annexation of our territories and the occupation of them. We have had a very intense winter time when the revolution was still going, and we were fighting for values. And I know that many Europeans have seen as much European flags specifically during those months of revolution, rather than seeing them in the, let's say, member states. And this is our aspiration stipulated in the constitution now, the European integration and entering, joining NATO, of course, as also for us, not just a military alliance, but an alliance of values. So as we were fighting for values back then, which is also our dignity, our independence, our freedom, our right to speak both, you know, Russian and Ukrainian language. And about the language, I am coming from the eastern city, Kharkiv, which is now around 2 million people inhabitants after the beginning of war and the occupation of Donbas, annexation of Crimea. We've received around 300,000 internally displaced persons, so with the population enlarged a little bit. It is mostly a Russian-speaking city, but no one is against hearing or, speaking Ukraine. Now it's even more popular, and we've conducted many special surveys with our international partners, showing that there was no hate against Ukrainian language, and at the same time, there is no need to protect Russian speakers. So my point referring to 2014 is to show and to explain that when this green man, or whoever they were, Russians, those who were occupying our territories and came to our land, were there to protect, let's say, my right as a bilingual Ukrainian and Russian speaking to speak Russian, which is absolutely crazy, you know? And this is a strategy Russia is using everywhere, almost where it invades. We remember, of course, the Georgia in 2008. We remember other instances with Moldova. But again, our aspirations of going forward and joining the European joining European Union, but not on that stage. Just signing an agreement, of the association agreement, which is like a roadmap to make our laws better in every field, irritated the leadership of Russia at the time and continues to do so today.
Can I just on the, you mentioned Donbas region and the majority Russian speaking population, but there are reports that say that that people have felt threatened by their Russian culture, their Russian identity. You're telling me that you don't believe that's the case, that there was no, because I mean, I understand both sides in a debate are going to actually. There has been a lot of, how do I put this, stories and then counter stories and then some propaganda, and then there's been issues. But I mean, we've seen some of the images with our own eyes, and it's not as peaceful and content as we would hope.
Absolutely not. I mean, we are still threatened by by the Russian side in this sense. It is a continuous imperialistic idea of dragging back us from our European perspective and actually getting back to our historical perspective of European family, rather than staying together or sticking together to a former USSR setup, which is the Russian leadership is trying to do. And of course, this is where the threat is. It's depriving us from our rights to choose our own future, including the fact that our culture is very diverse. Ukrainian language is now even more spoken in the schools, in the public places, in universities, even by foreigners, you know, even by foreign students, for instance. So the threat was to impose dramatically the culture, the former history, of course, the language, which would be coming on the top of all that, on us.
So when we say that 2014 was the beginning event, the annexation was the beginning event for this conflict. What we really mean is, it's yes, it brought some of that to the fore, but the culture differences have been going on for decades. Surely, a lot of the criticisms we aim at Russia on this network is how they treat members of the LGBT community. You know how they
absolutely we
would be very critical of that, but. How do you see it? I know you've campaigned in terms of sustainability, in terms of a human rights based thing, but how do you see a different, more inclusive Ukraine, and where does that sit in terms of the wider European and Russian community?
As I said before, the Revolution of Dignity, a very well known fact, happened straight after our former President Yanukovych did not sign association agreement back in Vilnius. And that shocked all the partners, because, you know, there were years of work, etc., and sustainability, environmental changes, these aspects are intrinsic in this document. Now it's our roadmap for daily work of all the committees of the parliament, for government, for strategies like 2030, etc., achieving sustainable development goals. And one of these aspects remains ecological challenges, environmental challenges. We are now seeing that after annexation, the rivers are disappearing, forests are disappearing. We see that the land, the soil is suffering. On the contrary, Ukraine has joined voluntarily recently the Green Deal. You know, no one pushed us. It was our own decision. And we are joining it with a very concrete plan of work. Recently, let's say 2 years ago, we've initiated a global initiative, which is called Greening of the Planet. And I know that Ireland also joined it. We've planted together with more than 120 countries across the globe, 14 million trees. And we think that, you know, changing the mind, the setup, and this is what differs us from our neighbors. We have never in our history trying to get someone's land or occupy someone. We were always protecting ourselves only. But this, you know, this difference coming from history, coming from mentality, and our friendly way of dealing with soft diplomacy, like this project of greening the planet and planted trees, which united, you know, ambassadors, politicians, business people, activists, school kids, students, etc. We are trying to show that with such initiative, we can bring more diverse dialogue, peaceful initiatives, and very progressive initiatives, and it deals directly with the challenges we are now facing. I'm sure that the next stage would be, and we see it from various articles, clean water, air pollution is already there, and we're trying to deal with it by modernizing our economy, which are everything linked in. So I would say very shortly, we are absolutely sure that it's not just ambitions on the paper. We're going through this, and we have more than 60% of this document, association agreement, fulfilled already. And that's about our daily life. It's about the air, it's about the water, it's about the baby food safety, about transportation, and other things. And that was our choice.
Okay, I'm accepting what you've said. I do think that it's worth talking about also through the prism of human rights and a rights-based society. I want to come back to NATO, if you don't mind. People know that your position, you would like to see Ukraine join NATO. Is that's correct?
I would say the recent polls, because it's very important to be linked with what people think, you know, mm-hmm. Politicians might want something, but that has to be reflected in the society. So we have more than 54% of people who are saying yes to NATO, and around the same figure, yes to joining the EU. That's very important, because we understand that, as I said at the very beginning, it's not just a military union of a 30 right now. Well, becoming a 31st for Ukraine is essential. We already have an annual working plan. We already have numerous trainings. Recently, we have received a lot of factual support, military support from different countries of Europe and Northern America. That is essential, because it's a fact. Ukrainian army today is the most professional and most developed army in terms of skills, in terms of active war, which is continuing to happen on the subcontinent of Europe. And that would be great for the alliance itself to have such a partner. What we are seeing right now, and again, coming back to Russian perspective of seeing NATO, yeah? Mm. Well, NATO is threatening Russia of a territory of 1,200 something kilometers. Russia is threatening the rest of the countries with thousands of kilometers of its territory bordering with us. You know, having us very close to it, as they are saying, a threat, because we have these ambitions of the NATO and European perspectives. It is a very firm message, which, for instance, recently NATO has received when Russian leadership asked to give a written explanation or written answer, written promise, let's say, that there will be no expansion of NATO to the east of Europe, which is absolutely unacceptable. Russia, and you've mentioned human rights, Russia is not just doesn't understand what human rights are, how to protect them. And the country and the leadership, Kremlin and Putin, he doesn't understand that the international rights, regardless of the changes of the constitution, when now national level prevails under international law, will always remain, and we are. We have to obey the rules. Well, I can say the game, because he's definitely playing with all of us.
But can you understand why people would say that unfortunately, and I mean this genuinely, unfortunately, Ukraine sits on, shares a border where people can walk across. There's no infrastructure. People can walk from the Russian territory into the Ukrainian territory.
Not really. Not really. I would make a remark here. As okay. I said, I'm coming from the east, and there was a project from 20, if I'm not mistaken, 16, running up until today. There's a lot of budget funds allocated to this very project. It's a border defense in terms of cameras. And I've been at one of this, you know, points of observation when it can target a distance of up to 5-10 kilometers, and you can see a person who's trying to cross illegally. We have been witnessed with this many cases by recorded videos at the border, and of course it is a border with Russia in the first place. So I wouldn't say there are many tourists like that who are trying to do so. If there would be one, and the camera can't can't get the particular image and act immediately for the border control, there is a special, well, I wouldn't say it publicly, because it's a border setup and it's sort of secret information.
It's security.
But trust me, there is a very good security right now, because we were not sitting and chilling for this 8 years. The infrastructure, as you said, is in the core of it, because once the Russian tanks from the point which is located not very far from my home city will start moving, well, they would have issues, because we've prepared something for that. What we are more afraid of is the Air Force defense. Now we're working on it with our European partners, US and Canada.
Just on the actual chances that there is further escalations of conflict and there is some form of invasion, do you think that's likely? Because, I mean, first of all, I'd love to think that this is just saber rattling, as people have said, or just, you know, a show of strength from sides. And I do think it's, I am not really exactly, I'm pretty anti-war all the time. Right. I'll tell you that clearly. And I don't know if NATO expansion is something that actually can be looked at as favorably, but that's not for me to decide. That's for democratic societies to decide themselves. But do you think we are, you know, what if I was to ask you, what do you think the risks are, or the chances are, of this actually becoming a full fledged conflict with some form of invasion?
I've received this question so many times through 8 years of war. The invasion happened back in 2014. We're dealing with it, and we are talking now if Russian forces are moving anyway further, you know, plus 1 centimeter, 1 kilometer ahead. I do not think it is happening for several reasons. It will be happening. But on the contrary, we have to be prepared, and we are. Now, you know that, winter time is not the best time to plan any invasions. And it's very hard to keep the soldiers warm, and very, very expensive at the same time. And we can remember 2014, all the hot stages were happening through summer and autumn. Point number two, we understand that everyone is talking so much about the plans, and the plans were even, you know, given in various articles, YouTube interviews, that we already know how it might be conducted, so that Russia making any moves right now would be very, very silly to do so, because everyone knows already what to be prepared for. This is point number two. So the plan was revealed, and everyone is talking about it. Unlike it was back in 2014. Point number three, I think that the very clear intention here is a little bit different. It's the direct talks of US and Russia. In his open essay, as it was presented, Mr. Medvedev, a former president of Russia, said, well, we understand that it's not him who said and wrote those words, but it's been said that We have no, we are not a state, we are not a country, we have nothing to do with independence, and it's better to get back where we were, basically to be joined with Russia again. And the very last point is Ukrainian parliament. You know that there are Minsk agreements, which are, well, I personally think that it's the worst document to be signed back then, but okay. Those who signed it had reasons for that. They were saving and stopping the bloodshed, etc. But a very last point of it, the very beginning is great. Ceasefire exchange, the prisoners all for all. By the way, Russia is blocking it constantly. We would like to fulfill that. It would be brilliant, but they can't agree to anything, especially the humanitarian issue of exchanging prisoners and finding missing persons. The very last point of this agreement is to conduct the elections first in the occupied territories of Donbas. And, you know, then we will try to have a border control under the OSCE observation mission. What is this about? It's about breaching all the possible, you know, security situation, having, you know, these people sitting in the parliament. Well, maybe we can conduct the elections, but only after the control of the border and only after Russia will leave our territory. But the purpose of Russia is to give, also there is an interesting point, to give the autonomy to these territories. And what then? Well, then Odessa might become an autonomy, Kyiv might become an autonomy, Lviv might become an autonomy. This is a first step to destroy Ukraine. And that's the real... I think it's a real intention of these stakes, which are already high. And Ukrainian parliament has to be strong not to vote of any kind of such proposals. And I personally wouldn't do so for sure.
Well, Mary, can I ask then? Okay, so accepting that this is how you feel about Russia's plan in the long term, do you feel that there is then any real diplomatic solution to this? Because it sounds like that, you know, it has to be, I mean, there's conversations now happening about whether this is a battle between autocracy and democracy. There's a battle of saying, well, NATO is in effect also expanding, and Russia feels under threat. And Russia is not the threat it was. It isn't even the 11th largest economy in the world anymore. So economically, it's not a superpower at that stage. Whereas, you know, we know China now is in effect an economic superpower and the real superpower. However, you know, I don't hear enough calls for some of the conversations you were involved in the Pace. Some of the things Russian delegates said, some of the statements that were made in terms of diplomatic solutions were described as offensive and problematic. So where's the diplomatic solution here?
Well, I think there would be a very hard diplomatic battle if we decide, well, if all the sides, all the stakeholders will be on the one page for this diplomatic solution. For us, diplomatic solution can only be one. Get Russia out, get reunited with the occupied territories of Donbas, get back Crimea, which is in every resolution, and you've mentioned now Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, PACE. In every resolution, even in the very recent ones of the last week, we mentioned that Crimea is an illegally annexed territory, an occupied territory by Russians. There are also things, humanitarian things, which we are discussing in these resolutions about Donbas. But we see that within 8 years, we haven't found, unfortunately, a diplomatic solution which will please Russia. But that just becomes, you know, quite ridiculous. One country is redrafting international law, redrafting the rules of mediation, trying to discourage the Normandy process, which has just restarted again, thank God. And we were as a country, as a president administration, we, parliament and government, we were really trying hard to get back to this diplomatic track. We are looking forward to the further developments in these talks. And from then onwards, we will see whether Russia will finally get back to the promises it's made, it has made, or it will continue. Because, I mean, I understand it doesn't sound quite diplomatic, but I think Putin is just going crazy. Like, he can't get any satisfaction from life. That's why he has to invade other countries. That's why he has to be involved in this continuous bloodshed. I don't know how many people across the globe hate him, but he is not doing a great thing for himself as well. Will Russia survive without strong leadership? That's another question. But to finalize my point, when Russia will see a strong Ukraine next to it, having great laws, having great infrastructure, which we're working on. After the last 2 years, we have the most amazing roads in Europe, I think, because we've reconstructed them quite heavily. When they will see that our trade with the biggest market, which is EU, is going even better. When they will see that visa-free is working, the aviation agreement is working, we have great deals for travels, we have amazing people-to-people contacts. All that is at place, and our economy is boosting, actually. And we have the protection of human rights, and we are free to express ourselves. So freedom is our second religion, let's say. Unlike in Russia, when they come out for a peaceful protest, silent protest, and they are being imprisoned. So when they see all that, they would want to become us. So strong Ukraine is the worst nightmare for Putin. That's why, and for his leadership. That's why he's doing all that.
Okay. Maria, Mezentseva, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I know you're actually en route to an airport, let's just say, at the moment. So thank you for talking
military, to us. Military airport, very, very close to the demarcation line, by the way.
Yeah, so I appreciate you taking the time. I hope listeners can see that perspective. And I mean, we know there's a big geopolitical game going on in the background here, but the people on the ground who are actually, you know, their lives are at risk, and it's their freedoms that are at risk. So I'm glad we got the opportunity to hear your voice and tell your side of the events. Thank you again. We'll be back soon, folks. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tony. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.